Chapter 11 of the Autobiography of Rudolf Steiner, entitled Chapters in the Course of My Life, 1861 to 1907. Each year I had to pass a test in the subjects I had enrolled in at the technical college. I had been granted a scholarship and could continue to draw it only by proving my success in those studies. My craving for knowledge, however, particularly in the field of natural science, was little satisfied by these required studies. In those days one could sit in on lectures and even participate in laboratory experiments at the Vienna Institutes as a guest student. I met helpfulness everywhere whenever I sought to enlarge my insight into the sciences in this way, including medicine. I can say that I never allowed my spiritual insight to interfere with acquiring knowledge of the sciences as they were then presented. I applied myself to what was taught, and only at the back of my mind was there always the hope that one day the union of natural science and knowledge of spirit would reveal itself to me. This hope was threatened from two directions. Every aspect of organic science that I studied was permeated with Darwinian concepts. To me, the propositions of Darwinism were scientifically impossible. Gradually, I came to build up for myself a picture of the inner human being. This inner being has a spiritual nature, and I conceived of it as a member of a world of spirit. I imagined this inner spiritual entity dipping down from the world of spirit into physical existence, and inserting itself into a bodily organism in order to perceive and act within the sense world. This image was not negotiable, even though I had a certain respect for the sequence of thought implicit in the theory of organic evolution. The idea of higher organisms evolving out of lower ones seemed fruitful to me, but to combine this idea with what I knew as the world of spirit was infinitely difficult. And the teaching of physics was permeated with the mechanical theory of heat and the wave theory of light and color phenomena. The course I attended at the mechanical theory of heat was particularly interesting to me personally. Those lectures were by a person whom I admired greatly, Edmund Reitlinger, author of the excellent book An Independent View. Reitlinger was a very charming and likable person. When I became his student, he had been suffering from an extreme pulmonary disease. For 2 years I attended his lectures on a mechanical theory of heat, physics for chemists, and history of physics. I worked under him in the physics laboratory in many areas, especially that of spectral analysis. His lectures on the history of physics were especially important to me. One felt that because of his illness, every word was spoken with difficulty. Nevertheless, his lectures were truly inspiring. His method of research was strictly inductive. He would quote from Whewell's book on inductive science for all methodical research. For him, the peak of research in physics was represented by Newton. His course on the history of physics was divided into two parts. The first covered ancient times until Newton, the second from Newton until the present. Reitlinger was a universal thinker. From historical considerations of problems in physics, he would invariably proceed to general perspectives of cultural history. He would even introduce general philosophical ideas into his lectures on natural science. Thus he examined optimism and pessimism, and spoke with great enthusiasm about the justification for building up hypotheses in scientific research. His presentation on Kepler was a masterpiece of scientific exposition, as was his characterization of Julius Robert Mayer. I was stimulated by Reitlinger to read almost all of Julius Robert Mayer's writings, and I often had the privilege and pleasure of discussing their content with him. I felt a great sorrow when this beloved teacher died from his severe illness, a few weeks after my last examination under him in the mechanical theory of heat. Shortly before, like a legacy, Reitlinger had given me recommendations concerning people who would provide me with students for private tutoring. This had very good results. A great part of the income that sustained me during the following years I owe to Reitlinger. The mechanical theory of heat, the wave theory of light, and that of the effects of electricity moved me to study theories of epistemology. The external physical world was at that time presented as a process of material motion, It seemed that sensory impressions were simply subjective experiences. That is, the human senses were affected only by processes of motion. Out there in space, the motion in matter occurs. When such processes contact the human sense of heat, there will be a sensation of heat. Outside are wave processes of the ether. When they come into contact with the optic nerve, they cause sensations of light and color to arise within. I met with this perspective everywhere, and it caused my thinking inconceivable difficulties. It drove all spirit from the objective external world. It was clear to me that if observation of natural phenomena could lead to such assumptions, one could not arrive at these assumptions with a perception of the spirit. I could see the seductive nature of such assumptions for the thinking of trained natural scientists, but I could not yet decide, even for myself, to place my own thinking against what then prevailed. But this is exactly what caused me such difficult inner struggles. I had to suppress again and again what seemed to be obvious arguments against the prevalent views, and await a time when other sources and paths of knowledge would give me greater certainty. I was greatly stimulated by Schiller's title Letters on the Aesthetic Education of Man. His indication that human consciousness oscillates between various states afforded me something to which I could link the image I had developed of the human soul's inner activity and weaving. Schiller distinguishes two states of consciousness that allow human beings to develop a relationship with the world. If we surrender to what affects us through the senses, we are compelled by nature. Our life is thus determined by our senses and drives. On the other hand, when we are subject to the laws of logic and reason, we are compelled by spirit. But we can also develop an intermediate state of consciousness and, quote-unquote, aesthetic disposition that neither surrenders one-sidedly to the compulsion of nature nor to the necessity of reason. This aesthetic disposition allows the soul to live through the senses but brings something spiritual to physical perception and to our actions stimulated by the sensory world. We then perceive with our senses as though they were permeated with spirit. When we act, we surrender to what pleases our immediate desire, but we have ennobled our desire, so that what is good pleases us, and what is bad displeases. Reason has intimately united with the physical. Goodness has become instinct, and this instinct may now follow its own inclination because it is spiritualized. Schiller sees a disposition of soul in this state of consciousness in which we can experience and produce works of beauty. By developing this state, one sees a revival of the human being's true nature. I was drawn to Schiller's train of thought. It says that consciousness must first attain a certain condition before its relationship with the world accords with the true nature of the human being. What this expressed greatly clarified the problems that confronted me as a result of observing the physical world and experiencing spirit. Schiller spoke of the state of consciousness needed to experience the world's beauty. Is it not possible to consider such a state of consciousness for mediating the truth in the nature of things? If so, one cannot, like Kant, observe immediately given human consciousness and investigate the possibility of it reaching the true nature of things. Rather, one must begin by investigating the state of consciousness through which a person enters a relation to the world that allows things and facts to reveal their real nature. And I realized that such a state of consciousness is realized to a certain degree when we not only entertain thoughts that portray external things and events, but when we have thoughts that we experience as the thoughts themselves. This life in thoughts revealed itself to me as completely different from the life of thought in ordinary existence and that of the usual scientific research. By increasingly penetrating the experience of thought, one discovers that spiritual reality comes to meet us within this life in thought. One follows the soul's path into the spirit. But the spiritual reality one meets along this inner soul path is rediscovered as the inner reality of nature. One gains a deeper knowledge of nature when one confronts nature after having seen the reality of spirit within living thoughts. It became increasingly clear to me that by going beyond our usual abstract thoughts to direct perception of spirit, while retaining the clarity of thought and circumspection, we enter a reality that distances us from ordinary consciousness. Ordinary consciousness gives us, on the one hand, a living quality of sensory perception, and on the other, the activity of abstract thought. The external world is perceived through the senses. Likewise, spirit is perceived with spiritual sight, except that thinking is not separated from what is perceived, what it perceives spiritually, as it is from sensory perception in ordinary consciousness. Rather, spiritual sight thinks when it experiences the spiritual, and it experiences when it makes the awakened spirituality in the human being think. A spiritual perception was disclosed to me, not through vague mystical feeling, but through spiritual activity that is fully comparable in clarity to mathematical thinking. I approached a state of consciousness that allowed me to justify my perception of the world of spirit, even to the forum of scientific thinking. I was in my 22nd year when I had these experiences. The end of chapter 11. Chapter 12. Music had become critically important for the kind of spiritual experience I wanted to secure on a firm foundation within myself. It happened that the quote-unquote Wagner debate was at its height in the culture where I lived. In my childhood and youth, I took every opportunity to enhance my understanding of music. My relationship to thinking required it. For me, thinking had its own meaning and did not merely receive content through the percept it expresses. This, however, led somewhat naturally into the experience of pure musical tonal form as such. To me, the world of tone in itself revealed an essential aspect of reality. Adherents of Wagner maintained with every possible argument that music should express something in addition to the tones themselves. To me, this seemed totally unmusical. I always had a sociable disposition, and consequently I had made many friends at the school in Wiener Neustadt and later in Vienna. My views seldom agreed with theirs, but this never prevented those friendships from being sincere and mutually greatly stimulating. One of my friends was a young man with a wonderful idealism. He had blonde hair and frank blue eyes, a typical German youth. He was completely carried away with Wagner. To him, music that just existed in itself and merely wanted to weave in the tones was obsolete and unsophisticated. In his opinion, tones had value when something in them revealed itself like a kind of speech. We often went to concerts and operas together, and our views always differed. The quote-unquote expressive music that sent him into ecstasy made my limbs feel like they were filled with lead, and he was bored stiff listening to music but simply wanted to be music. Our debates continued endlessly. On long walks or sitting by the hour over cups of coffee, he would enthusiastically attempt to prove that true music was born with Wagner. All that appeared previously merely prepared the way for Wagner, the quote-unquote discoverer of true music. This caused me to express my own views somewhat drastically. I spoke of Wagnerian barbarism as the grave of any true understanding of music. On certain occasions, our arguments would become particularly heated. All at once, my friend began to have a peculiar tendency to direct our almost daily walks to a narrow street, and there, while discussing Wagner, we walked up and down the street, often many times. I was so engrossed in our debates that only gradually did it occur to me why he had developed a preference for this particular street. At the time of our walks, a charming young girl would be sitting at the window of one of the houses. His only connection with the girl was seeing her at the window nearly every day, and his awareness that sometimes she glanced toward the street in a way meant for him. At first I noticed only that on this little street his defense of Wagner, which was usually fiery enough, burst into flames. When I became aware of the other emotions contributing to his enthusiasm, he acknowledged this matter to me, and I became a sympathetic witness to the tenderest, most beautiful romantic young love. The relationship between them never developed much beyond what I described. My friend, whose family was not blessed with worldly goods, soon had to take a minor job as a journalist in a provincial town, and could not even think about a closer connection with the girl, and he was not strong enough to master the situation. We kept in touch for a long time by correspondence, and his letters had a sad tone of resignation. He was unable to drive from his heart the memory of that separation. Long after our correspondence had ceased, I happened to meet someone from the town where he worked as a journalist. Since I had always remembered this friend of my youth with affection, I asked about him, and this person told me, quote, "Well, things turned out badly for him. He barely earned enough to keep himself alive. Eventually he was in my employment as a clerk, but he died of tuberculosis," unquote. The news cut me to the quick. I knew that circumstances had driven this fair-haired, idealistic young man to part from his first love, with the feeling that life was over for him. He could see no value in establishing a future that could be nothing like the ideal he dreamt of during our walks on that narrow street. In our discussions, my anti-Wagnerian feelings of that time found strong expression, but those feelings played an important part in my soul life as well. I looked in all directions for a way to enter music that had nothing to do with Wagner's kind of music. My love of pure music grew steadily for several years. My disgust with the quote-unquote barbarism of music that expressed something grew even stronger. In addition, it was my destiny that most of the people I would live among were admirers of Wagner. This contributed in no small measure to the fact that, much later, I found it very painful to struggle to an understanding of Wagner. This is, of course, the obvious and sensible thing to do in regard to such a significant cultural phenomenon. Nevertheless, this struggle belongs to a later period of my life. During the time I am describing, I found, for example, a performance of Tristan, to which I had to accompany one of my students, deadly boring. Another significant friendship also belongs to that period. This involved a young man who was in every way the opposite of the fair-haired youth. He thought he was a poet. I also spent much time with him in animated discussions. He shared a great enthusiasm for all kinds of poetry, and he assumed difficult tasks at an early age. When I met him, he had written a tragedy, Hannibal, and many lyrics. Together with these two friends, I attended Schroer's course on public speaking and written composition at the Technical College. Along with many others, the three of us were extremely stimulated by this course. We, young people, could lecture on subjects we had worked out ourselves, and Schroer would discuss them with us. Our souls were lifted by his wonderful idealism and noble enthusiasm. My friend often accompanied me when I was privileged to visit Schroer at his home. There my friend would always become lively. Elsewhere a heavy note often ran through everything he said. Because of an inner discord, he could not come to terms with life. No vocation so attracted him that he would have entered it gladly. All he cared for was poetry, and apart from this he found no real connection with life. At last he had to take a position in which he had no interest. I also stayed in touch with him by correspondence. It preyed on him that he gained no real satisfaction, even from his gift as a poet. To him nothing in life seemed to be worthwhile. To my great sorrow it became apparent both in his letters and in conversation that the notion was forming in his mind that he suffered from an incurable disease. There was nothing anyone could do to dispel this unwarranted idea. One day I received news that this young man, who was such a close friend, had taken his own life. I also developed a close friendship at this time with a young man who had come from German Transylvania to the Technical College in Vienna. We also met at Schroer's course. My friend gave a lecture there on pessimism. Schopenhauer's whole argument in favor of this philosophy of life was included in his lecture. Added to this was the young man's own pessimistic disposition. I offered to give a lecture on the opposite view. In words of real thunder, I refuted pessimism. I even called Schopenhauer an obtuse genius and capped my exposition with these words, quote, "If the previous honorable speaker is correct in his presentation of pessimism, I would rather be the floor upon which I stand than be a human being," unquote. For a long time, my acquaintances mockingly repeated those words, but it made the young pessimist and myself devoted friends. We spent much time together. He, too, considered himself a poet. I often spent hours in his room listening with pleasure as he read his poems. and he, on the other hand, took a warm interest in my spiritual efforts, though his interest was kindled more by his personal affection for me than by what I worked toward. He engaged in many delightful friendships, and often in affairs of the heart as well. He needed this, for his life was far from easy. He had gone through school in Hermannstadt as a destitute child, and even there he had to make a living by tutoring. He had the superb idea of continuing to tutor the private students he had acquired at Hermannstadt by corresponding with them from Vienna. He was not particularly interested in the sciences taught at the school college. Nevertheless, one day he did wish to pass an examination in chemistry. He had never attended a lecture nor opened a book about it. The night before the examination, he let a friend read a summary of the whole subject to him. Finally, he fell asleep during the reading. Nevertheless, he went with his friend to the examination. Both failed brilliantly. That young man trusted me without limit. For a long time he treated me almost as a father confessor, told me about his life, which was full of interesting events and often sad, but he was always filled with enthusiasm for beauty. He gave me so much friendship and devotion that it was very difficult not to cause him bitter disappointment now and again. For example, he often thought I did not give him enough of my time, but this was the way it had to be, because I had so many interests that he seemed not to understand. Ultimately, however, it all led to a deeper friendship. He always spent his summer vacation at Hermannstadt. There he again collected students to teach throughout the year by correspondence from Vienna. During those times I always received long letters from him. He suffered because I seldom, if ever, answered them. But in the autumn, when he returned to Vienna, he would run to meet me like a boy, and our life together would begin again. Thanks to him, I moved in a broader circle of people. He loved introducing me to everyone he knew, and I had a great thirst for social life. Through this friend, much joy and warmth came into my life. Our friendship lasted until his death a few years ago. It weathered many storms, and I will have much more to say about it. The end of chapter 12. Chapter 13. Looking back over my life, many human relationships and incidents come to mind that continue to fill me with deep love and gratitude. I cannot describe everything in detail here and must leave much unsaid about those personal experiences that were and always will be very dear to me. Those early friendships from the time I am describing had a peculiar relationship to my life's development. They compelled me to lead a kind of double inner life. My struggle with the questions of cognition, which then occupied me more than anything else, was always met with great interest by my friends, but with little active participation. I remained rather alone in the experience of these enigmas. On the other hand, I participated fully in everything that involved my friends. Thus my inner life was divided. I followed one path as a lonely wanderer, the other as a lively participant with others whom I held in affection. But very often this second kind of experience, too, had deep and lasting significance for my development. In relation to this, I recall especially a friend who had been a schoolmate at Wiener Neustadt. Then, however, we were not close. But later we become friends when we came to see, but later we become friends when he came to see me frequently in Vienna, where he eventually became a civil servant. Yet even in Wiener Neustadt he played a role in my life, though not in any outer sense. Once we were at the same gymnastic lesson, and he left a book beside me while he exercised, and I had nothing to do. The book was by Heine, and dealt with the Romantic school and the history of German philosophy. I glanced through it and was motivated to read the book myself. I found much in it that was stimulating, but I was intensely opposed to Heine's approach to certain aspects of life, with which I was deeply concerned. Yet to enter thoughts and feelings that completely opposed mine strongly stimulated me to re-evaluate the approach to life that my own disposition made necessary. Then I discussed the book with my schoolmate. The discussion revealed his true inner life of soul and formed the basis for a lasting friendship later on. He was very reserved and seldom communicated with others. Most people considered him odd, but he became very talkative with those few he did wish to communicate with, primarily through letters. He felt called, through his inner aptitude, to be a poet, and felt he possessed a great inner gift. He was inclined to dream himself into relationships with other people, particularly of the opposite sex, rather than enter such relationships in reality. Occasionally he came close to taking the step, but could not bring it to realization. In our talks he relived his dreams with depth of feeling and enthusiasm as if they were real. Inevitably he suffered bitterly when the dreams came to nothing. As a result, his inner life had no relation whatever to his outer existence. His inner life was again the object of tormenting self-observation, which was reflected in many letters to me and in discussions. Once he described at length in a letter how he viewed all his experiences, great or small, as symbolic, and how he lived with such symbols. Out of deep affection for this friend, I listened to his dreams, though, while with him, I always felt as though we were moving in the clouds with no ground under our feet. This was an extraordinary experience for me, who ceaselessly worked to find a firm support for life in knowledge. When I was with this friend, I always had to slip out of my own being and leap over into another skin, so to speak. He liked my company and at times worked out expansive theories about the, quote, difference between our natures, unquote. Nevertheless, because of this deep feeling of friendship, he barely noticed how little our thoughts harmonized. I experienced something similar in relation to another school friend from Wiener Neustadt. He had been in the grade below mine at the Realschule. We came in closer contact once he entered the technical college in Vienna the year after I did, and then we met often. Like others, he was not particularly interested in my deep concern with cognition. He studied chemistry, and his scientific studies made it impossible for him to be anything but skeptical toward the spiritually orientated worldview that absorbed me. Later in life, I learned from this friend how close he was to my views even then, but in those days he did not allow his inner being to express itself. So our long and animated debates were for me, quote, a battle against materialism, unquote. With all the arguments that science is supposed to provide, he opposed my conviction of the world's spiritual content. At that time, I had to use all the insight I possessed to eliminate the objections that materialistic thinking used against recognition of spirit. Once our argument became particularly heated, my friend, who still lived in Wiener Neustadt, had to return home each day after attending lectures in Vienna. I often went with him along the Allegasse in Vienna to the Southern Railroad Station. One day our argument on materialism reached a kind of climax, just as we reached the station and the train was about to pull away. I summed up what I still had to say, quote, "You maintain that when one says, 'I think,' it is merely the necessary result of processes in the brain and nervous system. You consider only these processes to be real. And the same applies when one says, 'I see something,' 'I walk,' and so on. But please notice that you never say, 'My brain thinks,' 'My brain sees something,' or 'My brain walks.' If you had really reached the insight that you maintain in theory, you would have to express it differently. You lie, in fact, when you speak of capital I. But you can only follow your healthy instinct against the implications of your theory. Your experience is different from what your theory advocates. Your very consciousness proves that your theory is false," unquote. My friend shook his head. There was no time to argue. While walking back alone, I reflected that it was really inconsistent with a particularly exact philosophy to refute materialism in this crude way. But the important thing to me at that moment was not so much to give undeniable philosophical proofs within 5 minutes of a train departure, but to express my inner, certain experience of the human eye. To me, the human eye is concrete reality that can be surveyed inwardly. To me, that reality was no less real than any external fact recognized by materialists. However, it is absolutely non-material. During the following years, my insight and knowledge of the reality and spiritual nature of the human eye helped me against all the temptations of materialism. I knew that nothing can disprove the reality of the eye. And it was clear to me that the eye is unknown to those who think of it as a manifested form of something else, or as the consequence of some process. What I wanted to express to my friend was that to me the reality of the eye was an inner spiritual perception. We fought many more battles in this field. In regard to general views of life, however, our feelings were on the whole so similar that the fierceness of our theoretical battles never caused even the slightest misunderstanding in our personal relationship. At this time, I began to participate more extensively in the student life in Vienna. I became a member of the quote-unquote German reading room at the Technical College. There, current political and cultural issues were discussed in detail in both large and smaller gatherings. In those discussions, all the views, possible and impossible, of young people were aired. Opinions clashed violently, particularly when officials were elected. Much that took place among these young people in relation to current events in Austria was stimulating but also agitating. That was when the national parties were becoming even more sharply divided. In Austria, at that time, one could experience the beginning of what eventually led to the breakdown of the empire and all the consequences that appeared after the World War. Initially, I was elected librarian of the reading room. As such, I set out to discover all sorts of authors whose works I thought would be valuable additions to the students' library. I wrote, quote-unquote, begging letters to these authors. Often, I must have written 100 such letters a week. As a result of this work, the library quickly grew. This had a side effect for me. It provided an opportunity for me to become familiar with a large range of current scientific, artistic, historical, and political literature. I eagerly read the donated books. Later, I was elected chairman of the reading room. In my case, this provided a difficult task. I found myself faced with a large number of diverse partisan views, and I saw relative justification in each of them. Nevertheless, the adherents of the various parties all came to me. Individually, they all wished to convince me that their own party was the right one. When I was elected, all the parties voted for me. In the meetings, they had paid attention only to my defense of what was justified. After I had been chairman for 6 months, everyone voted against me. By then, they had discovered that I did not agree as fully with any one party as its members wished. My sociable nature found the reading room very satisfying. Certain processes reflected within the student association awakened my interest in the broader spheres of public life. I heard a number of interesting parliamentary debates from the gallery of the Austrian Chamber of Deputies and the Upper House. Apart from measures adopted by Parliament that often affected daily life profoundly, I was interested mainly in the personalities of the delegates. Bartholomew Carneri, a subtle philosopher, stood every year at the end of his bench as the main speaker on the budget. His words were a hailstorm of sharp accusations against the Taffa ministry and defended German culture in Austria. Ernst von Pleiner, a dry speaker, was the undisputed authority on questions of finance. It made one shiver to hear his icy analytical criticism of the expenditures of Finance Minister Dunajewski. Ruthanian Tomasuk thundered against national minority politics. One had the impression that his main concern was to find words that at the moment were most likely to stir up antipathy for the ministers. Lienbacher, the shrewd clergyman, spoke with simple cunning. His head leaned forward somewhat and gave the impression of wise detachment. Gregor, of the Young Czech movement, had a cutting style. He gave the impression of being somewhat of a rabble-rouser, and Riga, from the Old Czech movement, was the very embodiment of the Czechs as they had slowly matured to self-awareness during the second half of the 19th century. He was exceptionally self-reliant, with inner vigor and a strong will. Otto Hausner spoke from the Polish seats in the right wing. His speeches were often simply a clever rendering of things he had read. At other times, with a certain self-satisfaction, he sent pointed accusations like arrows in all directions, and all flawlessly factual. A self-satisfied but intelligent eye twinkled behind a monocle, while the other eye seemed to express a satisfied yes to the twinkle. But he was a speaker who often said prophetic things about the future of Austria. The statements he made then should be read today. One would be amazed at his penetrating foresight. People at the time laughed at much of what became bitter fact only a decade later. The end of chapter 13. Chapter 14. I had no real insights into the public affairs in Austria that stirred me inwardly. I merely observed the extremely complicated situation. My deeper interest was aroused only when I discussed those issues with Karl Julius Schröer. I had the privilege of seeing him often during this time. His destiny was closely linked with the Germans in Austria-Hungary. He was the son of Tobias Gottfried Schröer, who was head of a German secondary school for girls in Pressburg, and who wrote plays as well as books on history and aesthetics. His books on history and aesthetics were favorite textbooks, published under the name of Christian Oeser. The poems by Tobias Gottfried Schröer, despite their indisputable significance and being greatly appreciated in smaller circles, did not become well known. They expressed opinions that opposed the prevailing political views in Hungary. They had to be published without the author's name, sometimes in German-speaking areas outside Hungary. The author would have risked not only losing his position, but severe punishment as well if his general views had become known in Hungary. Thus, even as a youth, Carl Julius Schröer experienced the suppression of German customs and culture in his own home. Under this pressure, he developed an intimate devotion to German national characteristics and German literature, as well as a great love for everything about Goethe. He was profoundly influenced by Gervinus's History of German Literature. In the 1840s, Schröer went to Germany to study German language and literature at the universities of Leipzig, Halle, and Berlin. After he returned, he taught German literature at his father's school and conducted a seminar. About that time, he encountered the Christmas folk plays performed each year by the German colonists around Pressburg. These plays presented national characteristics of the German folk in a way that appealed deeply to Schröer. Centuries earlier, Germans had emigrated from the western regions and settled in Hungary. They brought these plays with them from their native land, probably in areas near the Rhine, and continued to perform them during the Christmas season, as they had in earlier times. The stories of paradise, the birth of Christ, and the three kings came to life in these plays with a simple appeal of folklore. Schröer published the German Christmas plays from Hungary after he had heard them or had read them in old manuscripts still in the possession of the peasants. Schröer continued to go into German folk culture with increasing depth and liveliness. He went to the various regions of Austria to study their German dialects. He wanted to discover the individual characteristics of Germans scattered over the Slavic, Magyar, and Italian areas of the Danube monarchy. In this way, he compiled his dictionaries and primers of the Zipser dialect, as spoken in the southern Carpathians, the Gotsche dialect of a tiny German populace in Carniola, and the Hinze language of western Hungary. For Schröer, such studies were never only scientific. He identified completely with the phenomenon of folk culture. Through the spoken and written word, he sought to make its character conscious for those who had been uprooted from it by life. He became professor at the university in Budapest, but prevailing political currents made him uncomfortable. Consequently, he moved to Vienna, where he was entrusted as director of the Protestant schools. Later, he became professor of German language and literature. This was when I met him and had the privilege of becoming acquainted with him. At that time, he was completely concentrated on Goethe, editing the second part of Faust and writing an introduction. He had already published part one. When I visited Schröer in his little library, which was also his study, I felt surrounded by a spiritual atmosphere that was highly beneficial to my soul life. I knew that Schröer had been attacked by the adherents of the prevailing methods of literary history because of his writings, specifically his title History of German Literature in the 19th Century. Schröer did not adopt the style of the Scherer school of thought, which treated literary works as a scientist treats natural phenomena. He had certain feelings and ideas concerning literary manifestations and expressed them in a purely human way, without painstaking references to his quote-unquote sources. He was even accused of having written his History of German Literature, quote-unquote, off the cuff. I had little interest in that controversy. I felt spiritually warmed in Schröer's company, and I was privileged to spend hours by his side. Through his inspiring oral presentations, he brought to life the Christmas folk plays, the spirit of the German dialects, and the way of the literary life. In a direct, practical way, he clarified for me the relationship between dialect and cultivated speech. It was a joy when he spoke, as he did in his lectures, about Joseph Misson, the poet of Lower Austrian dialect. He had written the wonderful poem titled Ignaz, A Peasant Boy from Lower Austria Goes Abroad. At that time, Schroer would always lend books to me from his library, so I could further pursue the subject of our talk. Whenever I was alone with Schroer in this way, I always felt that yet a third was present, the spirit of Goethe. Schroer lived so strongly in Goethe's being and works that with every thought and feeling that arose in him, he asked himself, would Goethe have felt and thought in this way? Everything from Schroer was spiritually congenial to me. Nevertheless, even in relation to him, I had to independently establish the more intimate aspects of what I worked for spiritually. Schroer was an idealist. For him, the driving force in everything created, whether by nature or human being, was the world of ideas itself. For me, on the other hand, ideas were shadows cast by a living spiritual world. I found it difficult, even for myself, to say what the difference was between Schroer's way of thinking and my own. He spoke of ideas as the forces driving history. He felt that ideas have life. For me, the life of spirit was behind ideas, which were only manifestations of the spirit within the human soul. At that time, I could find no other expression for my way of thinking than, quote, objective idealism, unquote. By this, I wished to express that, as I experienced it, the essential nature of ideas is not that they appear in the human subject, but that they appear on the spiritual object, similar to the way color appears on physical objects, and that the human soul, the subject, perceives them there, just as the eye perceives color on a living being. When we discussed what reveals itself as the quote-unquote folk soul, however, it was clear from the way Schroer spoke that to a great extent my views came close to his. He described the folk soul as a real spiritual being, whose existence is expressed within the totality of those belonging to a folk. His words made it clear that he was not merely describing some abstract idea. From this perspective, we considered the makeup of the old Austria and the individuality of the folk souls active within it. From this, I was able to formulate thoughts that stirred my deeper feelings about current public affairs. Thus, my experiences at the time were connected strongly to my relationship to Carl Julius Schroer. Above all else, however, I worked toward intimate knowledge of the sciences, which were rather remote to him. I also wanted to make certain that my objective idealism harmonized with knowledge of the sensory world. It was during the period of most vital discussions with Schroer that the question of the relationship between the spiritual and physical worlds arose in a new way for me. Initially, this happened independently of Goethe's approach to natural science. Even Schroer could tell me nothing definite about this area of Goethe's work. It pleased him when he saw that one or another scientist gave favorable acknowledgment to Goethe's observations about plants and animals. But he found that learned scientists everywhere emphatically rejected Goethe's theory of color. Thus he never arrived at a definite opinion of his own on the subject. Although it was through Schroer that I came to a deeper understanding of Goethe's spiritual life, my relationship to science was not influenced by Goethe during that period of my life. I was influenced much more by my difficulty in trying to understand optics as explained by physicists. In scientific explanations, light and sound were interpreted by means of an analogy I found inadmissible. One spoke of, quote, sound in general, unquote, and, quote, light in general, unquote. The analogy went this way. Individual sounds and tones were conceived of as specifically modified vibrations of air and the objective aspect of sound. What lies beyond the human experience of audio sensing as a condition of vibration in the air. Light was thought of in a similar way. One conceived of vibrations in the ether to explain what occurs outside us when we see a manifestation of light. Thus colors are specially formed etheric vibrations. For me, this analogy was inner agony. I was absolutely certain that the concept sound is merely an abstract expression for the totality of all individual occurrences in the resounding world, and light represents a concrete reality distinct from the manifestations in the illuminated space. For me, sound was a collective abstract concept, light a concrete reality. I thought that light is not perceived by the senses at all. We see the colors through the light. Light reveals itself everywhere as perceptions of color, but it is not physically perceived itself. White light is not light, but a color. Thus, for me, light was in fact an extrasensory reality within the sensory world. Now the opposition between nominalism and realism, as it had developed in scholasticism, arose for me. The realists maintain that concepts are living realities, exist within the things, and are drawn out only by human cognition. Nominalists, on the other hand, thought of concepts as merely the names human beings had devised to sum up the manifold qualities of things, though they have no existence in the things themselves. I felt that sound experiences would have to be regarded according to the nominalist's view, and the phenomena experienced through light according to the realist's view. The end of chapter 14, and the end of this section of my reading.